WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Dr. William Karesh is a veterinarian whose patients live in the wild. He travels to the most remote parts of the world to diagnose and treat wild rhinos, buffalo, elephants, penguins, you get the point. He says, although the job sounds romantic, it's not one that most people would enjoy. It's arduous, uncomfortable, and sometimes dangerous. Dr. Karesh heads the International Field Veterinary Program for the Wildlife Conservation Society, which provides veterinary services all over the world for wildlife conservation projects. He's written a memoir called Appointment at the Ends of the World. When he's working with large wild animals, he has to sedate them first. It's not easy to sedate an elephant or a hippopotamus.
Probably the biggest challenge is getting close enough to dart them and have it safe for the team. Darts, there's a pretty widespread misconception with drug darts, and people, because the dart gun looks like a rifle, you just assume that it fires like a rifle. In fact, they're only good for maybe 30 or 40 yards at the most, as opposed to a high-powered rifle that can shoot, you know, 200 yards without a problem. So to dart an animal effectively, and you want to make sure the dart ends up in a nice solid muscle mass, you just can't hit them anywhere, you have to get pretty close. And getting close to elephants or rhinos or hippos or any large animals can be fairly dangerous because they don't like people being so close to them.
You were once given this advice: if an elephant charges, don't run. Wait till the elephant is nearly upon you and then dodge to the side. Did you ever have an opportunity to use that advice?
No, and I'm not sure it's even very good advice. But I always keep it in the back of my head there as a backup plan. Generally, forest elephants, that was really referring to. And deep, when you're deep in the forest or the jungle, you can only see maybe 10 or 20 feet ahead of you, sometimes, if you're lucky, 30 feet. So when you find an elephant, they're extremely close. And elephants, of course, have adapted in the wild to respond to that also. And they know that any threats they have, which would usually be from a human, are going to be very close. So forest elephants do tend to charge you if you're suddenly upon them or you surprise them. If they hear you coming from a distance, and they have very good sense of hearing, or if they smell you, if the wind's behind you and they can smell you, they'll usually run away and not let you get close in the first place. But when you surprise them, they'll often will charge. And local people say, you know, don't run, just hide, which I've certainly done in the past. I've been, you know, hiding behind a tree with the elephant bashing on the other side of the tree, trying to, I think, flush me out so I would run. But then also I work with some of the locals, like the Bayaka pygmies or the Mbuti pygmies, and they run like crazy when an elephant shows up, and they're very fast in the forest, so they get away. They manage to get away. I don't know if I think I'm too clumsy to run that fast. So you're always wondering what it is to do.
So how long did you have to hide behind this tree?
Oh, it seemed like hours, but I think it was just a minute or two. And then the elephant finally got bored or frustrated and ran off into the forest.
There's a picture of you in your new book of you covering the eyes of a rhino after you've sedated the rhino with a dart. You're covering the rhino's eyes with a large cloth. How is covering the rhino's eyes helping to calm the animal until the sedation takes effect?
Well, a lot of the drugs we use, you know, only act on certain parts of the brain, and in the case of rhinos and in the medication that we use to sedate them, they're in a very dreamlike state and they're unable to move physically, but they don't close their eyes. So covering their eyes, and we also put little earplugs in their ears made with socks stuffed with other socks, it just reduces some of the stimulation from outside. So it's almost a dreamlike state for them, and you don't want to surprise them or shock them, and it would be like almost arousing somebody in their sleep. Even though the drug makes it physically impossible, mentally we want to make sure they stay relaxed so it's not so traumatic for them. Also, out in the blazing sun, we're working right on the equator, and if they're not blinking or their eyes aren't closed, we we have to be worried about, you know, sun damage to the eyes. So that eye cover protects them not only from too much visual stimulation, but also just from the sun, so they don't end up with, you know, we don't want to cause a problem since we're really there trying to help these animals.
What kind of work were you doing with those rhinos?
With the rhinos, this was in northeastern Congo, Zaire, in a park called Garamba National Park. And we have a great team of people, biologists and veterinarians, actually, and we work together. There are only about 25 of this type of rhino left, the northern white rhino, only 25 or so left in the world, and they are all in this park. So what we're doing there was fitting those animals with radio collars, and later on we developed a horn transmitter where we could actually drill a hole in the horn of the rhino and insert a radio transmitter that operates on FM, just like this radio broadcast operates, and we could track those rhinos afterwards, and the park guards could actually follow the rhinos around and make sure they were protected from poachers.
And how has that program been working?
Well, it was great until the last two rebellions through the Congo, Congo Zaire. So it's very hard for the conservation workers to get in there and work, but sometimes they sneak in across the border and check up on things, and the park guards are still there, and it still looks pretty good for the rhinos. They've gotten pretty good protection, but we're always on the edge. It's right across the border from Sudan, and there's constant political unrest. So you never sleep well at night. There's no guarantees about what'll happen in the future.
I guess that's just one example of how political problems can interfere with your work with wildlife.
Absolutely. I mean, we have to consider that whatever we're doing with wildlife conservation has to fit into the real world, and the real world involves a lot of human beings, and of course that means politics. So people's agendas are different, and sometimes in order for a politician or an individual to take control of their region or their country, they might have to put wildlife a little lower on their personal agenda. And so we try to stay, you know, apolitical so we can work with both sides. And certainly in that instance in Congo Zaire, we work very closely with whoever happens to be controlling the region, because it's somewhat irrelevant for the animals about who the actual political authority is. So we're kind of happy to work with whoever decides that they're in charge. And a lot of them understand that for the long term, they want their wildlife resources available. So there's not an instant change of heart. I think a good example is in Rwanda with the mountain gorillas. As governments change, they still recognize the value of the mountain gorillas. So they were kind of spared most of the fighting and the impact of the wars.
Have you or any of the conservationists you work with ever been attacked by militia members or, you know, other people involved in political warfare?
Well, I can't think of an example where anybody's been under direct fire. There were certainly stories I hear about the episode in Uganda in the spring with the guerrilla tourism is a horrible, horrible story. More often, we just get held up by militia or rebels. It doesn't happen very often, but then again, it's not uncommon to be stopped by military with rifles, and they want to go through your baggage and ask a lot of questions, and you try and explain what it is you're doing. And I've certainly been lucky always to be released unharmed. I've had some colleagues and friends that have been kidnapped in the forest by actually secessionists, some people in the Congo Zaire forest that had not really had contact with the outside world for 25 years. And some of our teams going in to do survey work, you know, happened upon them. And there was a kingdom that none of us knew existed. And they were taken hostage by the king of the kingdom. They sent another person out for the ransom. And we ended up appointing the king as a wildlife advisor for the region. And he was very delighted by that and let our people go.
Tell me something more about the king.
It was a group, I think, they, during the 60s, right after Zaire became independent and there was all the fighting, And ultimately, that time as President Mobutu took control of the country, some of these groups that had fled from villages to get away from the fighting had fled into the jungle about, 20 to 30 miles from the nearest road, and just set up their own little world and never came back out to the road. So they were out in isolation essentially for 25, 28 years.
My guest is wildlife veterinarian Dr. William Karish. He's written a memoir called Appointment at the Ends of the World. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. William Karish. He's the head of the Field Veterinary Program for the Wildlife Conservation Society, which is located at the Bronx Zoo. He's written a new memoir called Appointment at the Ends of the World, Memoirs of a Wildlife Veterinarian. When you're trying to assess the health of a colony of penguins, for instance, how do you do it? Do you bring a stethoscope, take blood samples, stool samples?
We do all of that. The most important part before that is to link with the local government or the local conservation group to make sure that this is something they want done. And we're almost always invited in by foreign governments or foreign conservation organizations to assist them. And then it's just the logistical challenge of getting the proper equipment there. And we set up, we can work in the field with a solar panel and a 12-volt battery and have a microscope and a centrifuge. And then you actually go into the colony. With penguins, it's fairly easy to sneak up on a penguin and catch them by hand. And then you give them a physical exam, just like you would get a good complete physical if you went to your own personal doctor. And we take a blood sample and a stool or a fecal sample. And the blood samples we use, we evaluate them in the field initially, but then we also freeze them in liquid nitrogen and bring them back for laboratory testing. And we'll look at a whole series of infectious diseases. We'll run a toxicology panel to see if they've been exposed to heavy metals or pesticides or PCBs. And then all of that data, those results are combined then to give a profile for a given population.
What's the worst diagnosis you've had to give about an animal population that you've analyzed?
Well, we find a lot of important infectious diseases. Sometimes there are occasional die-offs. We've seen die-offs with swans in Patagonia from botulism. And it's not unlike the large die-offs you see in California, in the lakes of California, with waterfowl and botulism. There's also been anthrax outbreaks, which is a very deadly bacterial disease in wildlife in Africa, hippos, occasionally rhinos, buffalo. There's been tuberculosis. There's tuberculosis endemic in some of the parks in southern Africa. And we found tuberculosis and hepatitis in orangutans in Indonesia. So there's some potentially serious diseases. And then there's some other kind of low-grade chronic diseases, one called leptospirosis, which can infect humans, but we find it in antelope in Africa, and it can cause stillbirths or abortions in the antelope, sometimes high fever and even death on rare occasions. But it's contagious to humans, so we're concerned about the local people who hunt and eat these antelopes are also susceptible to getting these same diseases.
Well, let's get back to the tuberculosis and hepatitis that you found in the orangutan population. Once you diagnosed that the problem existed, did you do anything to treat it?
Well, the problem with treating tuberculosis in orangutans is that much like humans, you can treat the disease and get it to sometimes go away, but more likely it remains in the animal or the human's body at a very low level, or maybe sequestered off in a little nodule. Now, for humans, you would just say, well, that's fine, and every year you come back for a checkup, and we'll make sure the disease hasn't recrudesced or come back. The problem with orangutans is we can't ask them to come in for a checkup every year. So those animals, I certainly feel that those animals that are diagnosed with the tuberculosis, for example, they should be treated, but they can't be really put back into wild populations, because if the disease does come back into them, then they put these wild animals at risk. So we need to kind of have long-term care facilities or rest homes, whether it's a patch of forest somewhere where they can live but not put the wild populations at risk. Hepatitis, we don't know of a good treatment for in orangutans yet. There still needs to be some work on that.
What solution did you come up with for isolating the infected orangutans?
Well, the ones that are infected happen to be former pets, and this is not a natural disease. We went and looked at wild populations of orangutans, working with the Malaysian government. They're really great to work with, and found that none of these diseases exist in the wild populations, and that's why we feel so strongly about not releasing these infected animals. Now, these infected animals were former pets. There was a large pet trade in orangutans. The babies are very cute. People like to have them for pets, and they keep them in their homes. And that's how they develop diseases like tuberculosis and hepatitis from being exposed to humans. Now, those animals, because they are pets, they're comfortable being around people. So it's much easier to keep them in any kind of facility, whether it's a large island facility where they can range free, or maybe even, like I said before, a large patch of forest that's isolated from the wild populations. And I think those are good places to put those animals, and they're also great places where the general public can come and learn about orangutans. They can be nature centers or wildlife centers that serve an educational purpose. Since the animals are not very scared of people, they're easy to approach. You can see them climbing in the trees, and it's a great opportunity for them. And it's a nice life for the animals to be free in the trees and without risking these wild populations from the introduction of a disease that they have no resistance to.
You know, as a wildlife veterinarian, you travel around the world and, you know, you interact with animals large and small of all types. I wonder if your impressions of these animals and your reactions to them is often different from the impressions and the folklore of the people who actually live in the same area as the animals.
Yeah, absolutely. For one thing, I do, you know, I travel with my biases. And as a veterinarian, as a wildlife veterinarian, I'm already going in wanting to help the animals. And I have a natural awe for these animals. I have a great respect for them. I feel like the animals, you know, deserve to exist. And that's certainly partly from being a veterinarian, and then there's the whole North American or Western culture. We all come with that bias too, but it's certainly wrong to assume that people in other cultures and other countries feel the same way. And it's not a rude awakening, but I think it's a important awakening, and I am reminded of it constantly that local people have developed their thoughts about animals in a very different way than we might have. Here, we're so lucky to have all the resources we have in our culture, and people in poorer areas are more exposed to animals. They have more reasons to be afraid of animals. They don't always have the same educational background that we have, so they, instead of that, they have to develop cultural histories or stories to explain why animals do some of the things they do. An interesting example has been with elephants and forest elephants, that a lot of local people I work with believe that many of the elephants are really humans transformed into elephants, and that villagers at night will transform themselves into elephants. So when you come across an elephant, it may not just be an elephant, it may actually be a person. And that puts that elephant, working with elephants, in a very different light when you consider that they may actually be people instead of elephants. Even high-ranking government officials in some countries, you know, believe this is true. This is the way they were raised, and who are we really to say it's not true?
Does this end up ever affecting how you interact with animals?
It does, because I think we have to respect some of the local feelings about animals, and we try to come to some level of agreement, some place where we can both achieve our goals when we're working with local populations in those situations. On the other hand, most cultural groups, most indigenous groups, are also very dependent on wildlife as a resource. And that helps us a lot, because they understand that we would like to help them ensure a future for wildlife. And that makes sense to them, because for their children and their children's children, they also want to make sure there is wildlife available for generations. So,
where are you off to next?
By the end of June, I have to be in Mongolia. It's calving season for gazelles, and we're trying to help with develop a management plan in the steppes, the eastern steppes of Mongolia. It's the largest, one of the largest unfenced grasslands left on the planet. And over a two-week period, maybe 500,000 gazelles will give birth. So we're going to go out and do little neonatal exams, just like taking your baby to the pediatrician, and collect blood samples. We're trying to develop a health profile for that population and integrate that into a management plan for them.
What kind of management plan?
Well, the gazelles are an important source of meat and skins for the Mongolians, and they do harvest them at certain times of year, but the harvesting has always been based on a best guess rather than knowing really how many animals reproduce every year and how many die naturally every year. So we'd try and get some good objective information and see that if their harvesting practices really make sense. A lot like hunting is done in the U.S., it's like white-tailed deer in the East Coast they try to base it on reproductive rates and population so that they're continuing to be more, in this case, more gazelles. We don't want them hunted to extinction.
Dr. William Karesh heads the International Field Veterinary Program for the Wildlife Conservation Society. His memoir is called Appointment at the Ends of the World. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.